Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a keynote address followed by a panel discussion titled Accountable to Humanity, Justice in Darfur. Our keynote speaker is writer and activist Dr. Alex DeWall, a fellow of the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard University and director of Justice Africa London. Our panelists include Dr. Jennifer Leaning, co-director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, Omar Ismail, fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, and the Reverend Gloria White Hammond, co-chair of the Massachusetts Coalition to Save Darfur. Moderating the panel discussion is Susanna Serkin, deputy director of Physicians for Human Rights. We begin with an introduction by Dr. Jonathan Simon, director of the Center for International Health and Development at Boston University. Dr. Simon.
The first step in accountability is knowledge. And tonight is a night and an opportunity to deepen our understanding and to deepen our knowledge about the events in Darfur. The program tonight will be organized as follows. Dr. Alex DeWall will provide us through a keynote address on a brief historical overview of the conflict in the Darfur region and provide us an update on the current situation. Following Alex's remarks, Susanna Serkin will nominate a panel consisting of Dr. Jennifer Leaning, Mr. Omar Ismail, and Reverend Dr. Gloria White Hammond. Ms. Serkin will introduce the moderators at the time that she opens that session, but let me just take a moment to inform you or to educate you that Ms. Serkin is the Deputy Director of Physicians for Human Rights and has really spent the last period of her life as an advocate and an investigator of some of the worst of the atrocities that happen on our planet. And I look forward to her bringing to bear and facilitating through her moderation of the panel some of her insights, as she has been one of the documentarists who's brought to the global stage a knowledge and awareness of the events of Darfur. But my real role here now is to introduce Dr. Alex DeWall. And I was trying to think, how do you describe Alex? Okay. Now, Alex is clearly an activist with deep personal and political commitments to some of the issues. Alex, as many of you know, is a very prolific writer. Alex is an educator. Alex is a scholar. But I decided that the real description of Alex is as a practitioner. And for those of you that know Alex, you'll say Alex is about the last guy in the world that would be called a practitioner, okay? But Alex is a practitioner of peace and truly seen as one of the global experts on Darfur, and therefore asked, as we have asked him tonight, to address this public meeting. Alex was received a Doctor of Philosophy and Social Anthropology from the University of Oxford in a study of the 1984 famine in Darfur. So here you have a person who has really spent the last 20 years of his scholarly life trying to understand the roots of the conflict in Darfur. In that 20 years, I think his contributions have been certainly to educate us about the complexities of the conflict of the region, the deep-seated historical roots of the conflict, and to remind us of the importance of taking what he calls an ethno-political lens to understand the conflict. And he wrote of the importance of understanding, quote, the ethnic mosaic rather than the polarized Arab-African identity divide, which is so often used in the popular media to describe the conflict in the region. It's a true pleasure to introduce Alex and to welcome him to provide the keynote address.
Thank you, and this is an extraordinary and impressive turnout. I first went to Darfur as a graduate student just over 20 years ago, and like any good social anthropologist, I chose a place that was remote and that nobody had heard of. And for the next 15 years, I had to explain to everyone where Darfur was. No one quite knew the existence or the location of this place. Sadly, that is no longer the case. And Not only did I choose a remote place, but my first host was in one of the most remote and barren and arid parts of Darfur. He was an old Arab sheikh, nearly blind in his 80s, who was living out the last of his years in an extraordinarily bare landscape, just a landscape of rocks and rubble with a few thorn trees and great volcanic granitic plugs ringing the horizon. And he'd pitched his tent, his big black tent, on the sand. And as his people were impoverished and rendered destitute by the drought, he was doing his best to maintain pretenses of extravagant hospitality, slaughtering a sheep for us, serving us sweet tea on the carpet, on his beautiful Persian carpets spread out on the sand. And this old sheikh reminisced about he and his tribe, which was an Arab tribe. He was black, like all the all the people of Darfur, black and Muslim and a devout Sufi. He reminisced how his nomadic Arab tribe would take their camels further south to the farmland of the sedentary four farmers and would exchange meat and milk for grain and would graze their camels on the harvested stubble of the crops. And this old Sheikh Hilal Muhammad Abdullah was his name, was famous for his justice, and not only Arabs from his own tribe, but people from all the multiple tribes of Darfur, Arab and non-Arab, would come to his court because his justice was famous for its fairness, also famous for its swiftness. It would be delivered the same day in the best Bedouin tradition. Sheikh Hilal's son is even more famous. His name is Musa Hilal. He is the lead commander of the Janjaweed in Darfur today, and the man who is number one on the United States list of suspected war criminals, of genocidaire, and a man who is very likely to be indicted by the International Criminal Court in the coming months for some of the most gross crimes against humanity. And even when I was in Darfur, which was really the last years in which there was a measure of peace, in which one could travel the region and spend the night in a village without having to ask what was the identity of the people, without having to ask, are you Arabs, are you not Arabs? These questions just had no meaning at that point. But even then, as I was living there, the seeds of this disaster were being sown. The local seeds were in that disaster, the great famine that I studied in 1984 and 1985, and the way that impoverished so many people across the region, and particularly impoverished the nomads, left so many nomads without the means of subsistence, without the means of livelihood, desperately trying to scrabble some sort of livelihood from the few bits of farmland that were left to them. But it was also in those years that the civil war in neighbouring Chad spilled over, and militia from Chad ventured into Darfur with their own, with their arms, with their ruthlessness. And they began to make alliances with the local groups, particularly the local Arabs, and instigated the first war that so disfigured Darfur in the late 1980s. And the other thing that was going on at that very moment was the war in southern Sudan that was being ratcheted up at that moment, a war that in the end lasted for 20 years, that saw many of the same gross abuses that we have seen in Darfur, mass killings, plunder, pillage, even enslavement of people in that conflict. And the critical decision was taken actually while I was in Sudan, where a decision by the head of military intelligence that the main instrument that they would use in fighting that war in the south would not be the regular army. It would be a militia or a series of militia. And they travelled, and he and some colleagues travelled across the borderlands between North and South Sudan, setting up a whole string of militias that would ravage the southern Sudanese over the subsequent years. And it was that strategy, the strategy of stoking local conflict, of arming local tribesmen, of giving them utter impunity, of declaring any area in which there was a conflict an ethics-free zone in which anything went, in which one simply needed to give the order, go out, do what is necessary, don't report back. And it was that particular tradition of utter impunity, of utter contempt for human rights and the rule of law that over the years ratcheted up the conflict, not only in southern Sudan to the appalling levels that we saw, but planted the seeds of the explosion of violence in Darfur. Over those years, between the late 1980s and when the conflict erupted into national and international consciousness in 2003, there were multiple militias in Darfur, creating local wars, acting with impunity, acting with the blessing of these men, chiefly from military intelligence. There were, I think, two really fundamental structural causes of this conflict that we must attend to. One was the complete impunity of those in charge of these military strategies. They were never called to account. None of them has ever been charged in a court of law. None of them has ever been disciplined. Some of them have left the service. It is simply because they have served their time in military intelligence and gone on to a comfortable retirement in the villas outside Khartoum. And I think it is this complete lack of accountability for crimes over decades that laid the foundations for what happened in Darfur. And if there is no accountability for what is happening now, I fear that this same cycle will be repeated. The second cause, of course, was lack of democracy. The fact that Sudan has aspired to democracy. All Sudanese will tell you they have had democratic aspirations, democratic interludes in the past, and the country actually at various times in its past has had an extraordinarily vibrant tradition of liberalism with a free press, with free and fair elections. But for the last 17 years it has been ruled by a military dictatorship that came to power overthrowing a flawed but nonetheless real democratic experiment in Sudan. Were there to be democracy, were there to be all the things that go with democracy, like a free press, like a functioning judicial system, like mechanisms for the relatively fair distribution of the nation's wealth, this would not have occurred. There would not have been the impulse for Darfurians to take up arms in what was, I think, in many ways a very tragic miscalculation. In fact, one of the leaders of the rebellion, Abdul Wahid al-Nur, told me in Abuja when he was actually refusing to sign the Darfur peace agreement, he said to me, had I known what would happen to my people, I would not have started this revolution, which I think was a frank admission of his own miscalculation. And one might almost say irresponsibility. Some of the rebel leaders have to also be called to account for their disastrous leadership, their own abuses of human rights. The situation in Darfur is disastrous. It is not getting better. To my mind, it doesn't matter whether we call it genocide or not. Genocide is a very simple, big name for a very complex and very horrible situation. A rape is a rape whether it's part of genocide or not. A famine is, in my book, a crime whether it is part of genocide or not. Those in the United Nations International Commission who refused to use the word genocide said crimes as heinous as genocide have been committed in Darfur. And in my book, that's good enough. I don't think we should get hung up on the question of is this genocide, is it not? This is a distraction. There are horrible crimes, horrible things going on now, today, that need to be brought to an end. I think our number one aim now is stop the killing. The killing has to be stopped on all sides. It is primarily the government. It is primarily the government and the associated Janjaweed because they have greater capacity. They have a greater sense of impunity. But some of the rebels are pretty nasty too. What's needed, I believe, is a ceasefire. I happen to be a skeptic about military intervention. I think that the idea that the United States should send its own troops to impose a moral order in parts of the Muslim world is an idea that does not travel well just at this particular moment. I think that the record of interventions is not good. I think that a lot can be achieved without such an intervention, and I personally have been calling for a ceasefire, a properly monitored ceasefire, as the immediate step to stop the killing. And then in that context, when you have a peace, then you can have peacekeepers. Then troops can actually fulfill some sort of function. But we mustn't take our eye off the real long-term issues that will not only bring this to a conclusive end, but prevent it from happening again. Accountability. The International Criminal Court is on the case. It is shocking that the United States is not only not a signatory to the statute of the International Criminal Court, but is not actually cooperating with the ICC. What will happen if, in a couple of months, the ICC issues an indictment against a senior Sudanese general for crimes against humanity? And most of the world lines up and says, we insist that this man is extradited to face trial in The Hague, and we will not cooperate with the government of Sudan until this happens. The United States' position on the ICC is one of non-cooperation. I think it would be shameful if, across the international community, it is the United States that is the one breaking ranks on that. And the other thing that is absolutely essential is democracy for Sudan. The North-South war came to an end almost 2 years ago, and it came to an end with what was called, rather misleadingly, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. It wasn't comprehensive. It didn't include Darfur. But it had some remarkably strong elements in it, and the strongest is free elections in 2009. And if the Sudanese are able to vote freely in 2009, surely they will not vote into power those who have perpetrated such horrors on their own country. It is those elections, I believe, that more than anything else hold the key to a fair and just future for Sudan. So this, I believe, is the other thing that we must really focus our efforts upon. And I'm tremendously encouraged that across this country, across the world, there is such an outpouring of horror at what is going on and an energy and commitment to putting it right. And I think this meeting is an extraordinary example of that. And I really commend the organizers of this and to all of you. Thank you.
I'm Susanna Serkin. I'm going to call up our very distinguished panel. So first, Jennifer Leaning, who's a physician. She's professor of the practice of international health at the Harvard School of Public Health and co-director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. And Jennifer herself was with my organization, Physicians for Human Rights, in Darfur conducting an investigation on the Chad-Sudan border in 2004. We are very fortunate to have with us in Cambridge this year Omar Ismail, who is a fellow in human rights policy at the Carr Center. Omar has recently come back from the region. He's the co-founder and director of the Darfur Peace and Development Group and has also been a founder of the Sudan Democratic Forum, which is a think tank in Washington. He really has extraordinary insights about not only his fellow Darfurians, but also the environment right now and even what's going on today. Reverend Dr. Gloria White-Hammond, a wonderful pastor and physician. Gloria is really a national leader on Darfur. She recently served as the national chairperson for the Million Voices on Darfur. Remember when many important people spoke, including George Clooney and others, on the mall in Washington. Gloria was the leader of that. She's also on the Massachusetts Save Darfur Coalition and is the founder of a wonderful group, which she may tell us a little bit about, My Sister's Keeper, that works in southern Sudan, helping girls get educated and achieve their rights. And so what we're going to do really right now is engage with this panel and follow up on Alex's talk and learn from this really extraordinary group. They may disagree with each other on a couple of points, and we'll get into that too. But I want to start, before we follow up with some questions for following on Alex's talk, with Omar, just to maybe tell us just in a few words what's going on as we speak.
Thank you, Susanna. And thanks to the students and the faculty. Today we are talking about accountability and the responsibility of all of us to end human suffering. And I think there is a good chance some of us present today are going to carry on holding that torch and helping humanity at large. Al-Fashir has been the capital of the greater Darfur for the last maybe 400, 500 years. And it is the largest urban center in that region, together with Niala in South Darfur and Al-Jinina in West Darfur, became the garrison towns. Anybody who had any experience in civil war, especially in the Sudanese context, we've seen this happening before in the south. When the countryside is attacked and the people are fleeing, most of these people go to the garrison towns, the bigger towns where some place like Juba, for example, in southern Sudan, a huge town of 500,000 people living there. In the beginning, you see this influx of the people from the countryside running to these urban centers. And you see them, you think that it is supposed to expand because more people are coming, but it actually shrinks. Maybe because the feeling of these terrorized people that if they congregate, if they come closer to each other, they will be safer. And I've seen that in Malakal and Juba and Wau before. And I've seen it in Mogadishu. I've seen it in Kismayo. I've seen it in Basaso in Somalia. I've seen it in Ethiopia. You know, I went to a lot of war-ridden areas and worked there. And I've seen the same pattern. So you see 500,000 people coming into Al-Fashir, and Al-Fashir is getting smaller because the people, everybody doesn't want to live in the outskirts of town, and that is where the attack is going to happen. The danger of this kind of escalation of war is the fact that if we look at Niala in the Kalma in IDP's camp, and this is a distinction, technical but important, the people who are moving inside the country where the crisis happens are called IDPs, internally displaced people, versus the refugees that are crossing international border into another country. And we have 500,000 of the Darfuris, mostly in Chad, that are characterized as refugees, but the 2.5 to 3 million Darfurians that are roaming the hills of Darfur and going into the garrison towns are IDPs. So a Kalma camp in Niala has about 150,000 IDPs, and these are all civilians. So you can imagine an attack in a place like this. Just if they are fleeing and they're stumbling over each other, a lot of people will be killed and injured. And so that is happening in Al-Fashir, where Abu Shouk camp, that has been famous for the visits by all the high-flying persons from around the world, most notably people like Colin Powell and the Secretary General of the United Nations. So that is where the danger is now. This new phase of escalation of war is very dangerous, and we need, like Alex said, we need a ceasefire. We need to control that violence so that we can go further into trying to find a solution to this problem.
Alex did an excellent job of conveying a certain landscape in Darfur, and he could talk about many other landscapes as well, because he traveled in many parts. I was on the Chad-Darfur border in the early summer of 2004, with the first of three investigations that Physicians for Human Rights launched to assess what was happening to the people on Darfur side of the border by talking to the refugees that Omar has referenced, that is, the people who had fled across. And this is as of May and June of 2004. So the war had been going on for a little over a year, the really frank, open war, this latest phase of what, as Alex has referred to, as a long war. But this very explosive, very visible, quite widespread war had been going on for a little over a year, and yet the international community had not been paying very much attention to it until the early spring of 2004. There had been monitors, there had been some humanitarian work, but it was a long time coming, so in terms of international focus. so that when we were there in May or June of 2004 on the Chad Darfur border, which is a very long border, it's well over 800 miles, and it traverses much of North Darfur and much of West Darfur and goes far down into the Central African Republic border. You need to look at a map of Sudan to see what a vast country it is and how huge that line, that border area is, to understand, first of all, the difficulty in assessing what is actually going on inside Darfur, but also on the border areas, and secondly, to see how a war there that is not contained, that has all of the energy and agents in it that Alex referred to or hinted at in terms of Chad's participation, and one could go north, one could go south, and one could go west in terms of the implications for this war if it is not contained. You have to look at a map to see how pivotal this conflict in Darfur is to the future of a large swath of Africa, the Horn of Africa, and the entire Sahel. So our plan was to fly into N'Djamena, which is the capital of Chad. If you look at a map of Africa, N'Djamena is smack dab in the middle of that big bulge of Africa. It's smack dab in the middle, but it's a long way to the Chad-Darfur border. And so we traveled from N'Djamena to the border. And then what we found is that there are large sections of this border as of 2004, and it's still the case, that were considered too unstable, too uncharted, too still possibly filled with mines and explosive remnants of war from earlier conflicts. And that was one part of the border. And another part of the border had thousands of refugees that were coming in from Darfur, and nobody had yet counted them. Nobody knew where they were. They were self-settling right on that border with relatively generous but very poor families that lived in Chad. And then there were sections where there were refugee camps just starting to be built. So a year into this conflict, over a year, the international community was very, very slow in responding to what was then billed as 180 to 200,000 refugees. We traveled as much as we could up and down that border from the south to the north and found that ecosystem changed. It was just at the start of the rainy season. In the south, it was warm and the rains were coming. It was still very, very dry. And if you looked at the land for a moment, it looked as if it were unpopulated. And then you paused and there were always people on the horizon or people who had come there. And if you got out of any vehicle you were in and you started to walk, you realized that what was sand was also filled with dry dust bunnies that were remnant dung from animals. And it very clearly became a country that was already, this is the Chad-Darfur border area in the south, it was already overgrazed and overpopulated, as poor as it looked and as barren as it looked. And as you move north, all the maps that show any sign of green as you pass the town of Abeche in Chad, which has just recently been overrun by a range of militia. If you go north of Abeche and you look at any map that still has that area as green, it is a ridiculous map. It is out of date. It is not paying attention to what the Sahara is doing and what drought is doing. It is desert. You feel as if you're in basically the start of the Saharan desert and you're heading into Libya. It feels as if you're heading into Libya, what one might imagine the Libyan desert to be. And so much of this, the refugees and much of this area is extraordinarily dry and basically sand and rock and wind. And it is in these conditions, very bleak conditions, that the refugees first landed. And in the last year and a half, 2 years, the international community has set up moderately okay refugee camps, but they have to keep moving them inland because it's not because they run out of space for taking care of the refugees, although the numbers are increasing, is that they run out of water. Drilling very deep boreholes, they still can only sustain 15 to 20,000 people in a refugee camp, and then they have to move them and find others and other sources of water. It is an extraordinarily poor and remote part of the world, as Alex was saying, and it is a place that cannot support this kind of density of refugee settlement. What we found in talking to the people is that they had experienced a massive wipeout of their towns, their villages, their property, their animals, their possessions, their heritage, the few that had rugs, the many that had gold, the many that had animals, the many that had farms, all of their stored and dried foodstuffs, all of their containers for carrying anything. They had also suffered enormous losses in their extended family. In our surveys, which we did over a period of time, small numbers not extrapolatable back to the Darfur region for reasons of sampling and for reasons that, which we can go into in terms of what is a representative sample in these refugees. But what we were finding is that the sex ratio, the male-female ratio in these refugee camps showed that there were for every one woman, you had 0.6 men. The men were missing. And that you had a very widespread story of rape and plunder. There were primarily older women, younger women, kids, a scrawny donkey that might have survived, and stories that people were able to say, but not with any particular vividness. And this is in part because these are country people who are talking to you through at least two translators, in this, and we can go into the translation difficulty. So it's partly that they speak in concrete ways and you're talking through translation, and it's part because we were talking to people who, even if they had been there in relative refuge for 2 or 3 months from the events that drove them into Chad, they were still stunned and still struggling to come to terms with what their past had been, which is now wiped out, and what their future could possibly be. And this is still the situation. It is now getting worse, both in Darfur and in the refugee setting. And the conclusion that we are coming to is that the society that Alex saw in 84-85, the society that Omar comes from, the society that some of us have begun to understand and read about as we begin to care about this part of the world, that society is gone. It has been destroyed in these last 3 years of war. And whatever lies ahead is an unknown. But most of us feel that even with a ceasefire and even with a very extensive process of accountability and reparations and justice for various dimensions, we have lost an incredibly important, integrated, subtle, and interrelated set of societies in Darfur. And it is through our inaction, our incapacity to get coherence from the international community, and it is going to be on the records as one of the great failures of the international community at the start of our 21st century.
Jennifer, thank you for that briefing. There's so much to pass on in terms of the contours of this crisis. Gloria has been really at the forefront of activism and advocacy, and also brings some knowledge and focus from Southern Sudan as well. So Gloria, give us a few words. What's on your mind?
Sure. Well, again, I certainly want to echo my colleagues in expressing appreciation for your presence here tonight. As you know, many of us have been involved in Sudan for a few years, and a few years ago you would go to, first of all, they wouldn't have these four, and if they did, there weren't very many people here. One of the points that I want to make from the outset is when we tell the full story of Sudan, it becomes discouraging for people. And so for me, one of the challenges as a woman of faith, I get paid to have faith, is is to be grounded in the reality of Sudan, but not be mired or paralyzed by the reality of Sudan. And so one of the reasons that I'm excited to be among a group of students is because historically students have been bifocal in the sense that you've been able to see what the reality of the present is, but to force the rest of the world to look to another future and a brighter future. And so we are very much relying on you as students to push us past this reality to get to another place. And again, I'm very appreciative of your presence here. About 2 years ago, I sat in a group of about 20 women who represented every region of Sudan. And the question came up as to accountability and how to really respond to this government in the wake of all that has happened in Sudan. There was some tension around that, which shifted when one woman said that I myself have not been violated, but I act on this truth, that if my sister has been raped, then I have been raped. And so I've come to this issue in that context, that as a woman, my sisters have been raped, and therefore I operate as though I too was raped and am committed to speaking out on their behalf. I first became involved in Sudan in July 2001 when I made my first trip there. As you've heard, the war in southern Sudan, that civil war that pitted the government of Sudan, which is based in Khartoum, against the southerners, had gone on now for some 20 years, and one of the byproducts of that was slavery. As you know, this scenario, it's you've read it over and over again, the Arab militia into the villages, killing the men, raping women. And in southern Sudan, sometimes the mostly women and children are taken into the north where they are sold into slavery, chattel slavery, with experiences very much akin to the experiences of my ancestors some 400 years ago. When that news broke in America, there was a good bit of consternation, as you can imagine. A group that's based here in Boston, the American Anti-Slavery Group, working with another group based in Zurich, Christian Solidarity International, pretty much at the behest of local villagers in southern Sudan, supported a very elaborate underground railroad, controversial underground railroad, which saw the return of people who had been enslaved in the north back into their villages in the south. I met with a number of these individuals, especially the women, heard their stories, and then subsequently with six other women formed a group called My Sister's Keeper that has now focused on providing girls' education in one village in southern Sudan, and we now have almost 1,000 girls in school and in a primary school. We have raised over $100,000 and are now looking to actually construct the campus now that there's peace in southern Sudan, and are very excited about that. When we went to dedicate the school about 2 years ago, the girls greeted us with a song that roughly translates into, "It is now our turn to be in charge. It's our time to rule." And so we are helping the girls live out their girl power, and that's very exciting for us. Because of my commitment to the people of southern Sudan, and really at their prompting, I then traveled into Darfur in February of 2005, and visited with in two camps in Niala, and met with some 60 women in small groups over about 5 days. Over that period of time, I heard stories of unconscionable abuse. Something like, 24 of the 60 women, 40%, reported being raped, gang raped. Again, you know those stories. But I see this very much as a woman's issue and as a part of a culture of violence against women that is operating worldwide with impunity. So I encourage women and people who care about women to speak out on the situation in Darfur and to see that as an opportunity to confront the perpetrators of violence against women worldwide. And my work is to keep all of us encouraged. And I, despite all that we've heard, firmly believe that if we are creative enough and resourceful enough and work hard enough, that history will reflect that a grassroots movement was mobilized and we did, in fact, stop a genocide. So I thank you for partnering with us in this effort.
I just want to get a couple of clarifications on sort of where the situation is now. As we've heard that we have the International Criminal Court, even in spite of perhaps the U.S. not cooperating as we'd like, they did allow it to be referred to the International Criminal Court. They have not been able to go to Darfur to investigate. That's one piece, accountability. There's a massive humanitarian effort underway. Jennifer talked about the current conditions, but there are many, many parts of Darfur that are no-go areas for the humanitarian operation because it's simply too dangerous, too violent. The fighting is too intense, and roads are blocked and so forth, and that's in sometimes in both directions, the rebel roadblocks and car hijackings and attacks on humanitarian workers, as well as a lot of these attacks coming from the government of Sudan cooperating with the local Janjaweed militias. But by and large, we've heard that, you know, people are not yet at this point starving to death, but that could happen if there is a massive pullout of humanitarian workers. And then, most importantly, we're talking, as Alex said, stop the killing. So what I want to ask any or all of you is, you know, we know that the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution calling for the current force of African Union, 7,000 African Union troops to be, who are supposed to be keeping what is not really a peace. And mostly they can just monitor and they can't really stop violence. To become a UN force. But that had to have the consent of the Sudanese government. President of Sudan has vehemently opposed such a force, and as we've heard in recent days, most experts, observers, and participants in all of this believe that there is never going to be a UN force, that's pretty much gone now. So the question is, what is, in the next weeks or months, the way in which you see the violence stopping?
Yes, as Susanna has said, not only has President Bashir rejected the handover to a UN force, he's also rejected the compromise that was put forward, which was a hybrid African Union UN force. And what this actually presents us with over the next month is a very serious problem, because the African Union force has just had its mandate extended for another 6 months, but it has no money. Its money runs out on the 1st of January. Now, what the situation of the AU force is, it suffers from a number of problems. At the moment, there is no political leadership. There is the person who was nominated as the AU special representative for Sudan was vetoed by Khartoum, so there is actually no political leadership of the AU in Khartoum. That may change. Hopefully they will appoint someone soon. In fact, most likely they will appoint a joint representative of the UN and the African Union, which would, I think, be a step forward. At no time has this AU force been able to develop a plan of operations. And I think more fundamental than the numbers of troops or the mandate or the amount of armor is actually having a plan, because this problem is going to take a long time to be solved. It cannot be solved overnight, even if 40,000 NATO troops were to arrive in Darfur tomorrow. They would not be able to stop this, not for many months, even if they had the goodwill of the Sudan government. There needs to be an approach that actually gets the communities of Darfur on side. The Darfurian communities themselves are the greatest asset in this, and many of them are armed. They have their local village militia, and these should be, as it were, the force multiplier. They should be the eyes and ears of any international force. And it's only when a force is there and the commander knows that he and his troops are going to be there for 4 or 5 or 6 years, and he actually is staffed up not just with military personnel but with political officers, community liaison officers, that he will actually be able to do his job. Effective peacekeeping in these circumstances is 9 parts political work and community liaison to 1 part force. Now, the situation we have at the moment is that the AU force, it runs from month to month. There was a time over the last summer when for 2 months the troops were not paid. At no time have they known, since the troops first arrived, at no time have they known how long they're going to be there, more than a few months in advance. And at the moment, they don't know if their salaries are going to be paid in January.
Is that roadblock the international community? The money's not flowing through, or it's not being given? I know that, there was U.S. legislation to give $50 million past year to the AU. Just a teeny bit? Is it not getting through?
Was actually blocked. It was actually authorized, and then I don't know the politics of Congress, but it was actually
hasn't
blocked.
Gone through yet.
It didn't go through. And ironically, the AU is actually cheaper to run than the UN. And I think the very first step is actually to say,
Yes, we'd much rather have a UN force. We all know that it would be better, but let's at least make what we have work. And the underfunding of the AU force and the lack of any long-term commitment is frankly shocking.
Omer, do you have a response?
President Bashir rejected the hybrid intervention after...
Hybrid meaning African Union plus UN.
Plus the UN. And this is a compromise that was reached in Addis Ababa after he vehemently, blocked the 1706 from being implemented. And true to the fashion of the government of Sudan, agreeing on something and then reneging on it. And this has been going on and on and on. Not just, negotiations like this in Addis Ababa, but peace agreements signed on the dotted line, and they came back and they reneged on them. Besides the fact that they use every obstacle to delay the whatever that part that they wanted to do, like the visas for international workers and the permits to travel and the permits to work and also creating conditions that is making it difficult for people to go. Most of these IDPs are in places where the international assistance cannot reach them because the government of Sudan is creating these conditions of lack of security for the international agencies to go and be able to do that. So in the peacekeeping, I would say, short of a regime change, nothing is going to help. But that is a word that is politically incorrect and nobody wants to touch that. And this is an option.
Elections in 2009?
Well, until it's an option that only the Sudanese people will exercise, and they will, definitely. So what can we do in the international community? I think the obligation of accountability and the right to protect, which is voluntary, and then it becomes the responsibility to protect, and then we look at the tools to exercise that protection. The African Union is underfunded and it doesn't have the experience. It doesn't have two political officers, 7,200 troops that in a real estate area the size of France, and they don't have the mandate because they are not there to provide protection to begin with. Actually, it's widely believed that the African Union troops that are in Darfur are protecting people. No, wrong. They are there. Their mandate is to provide security for civilian observers that are writing about ceasefire violations, ceasefire that doesn't exist, was signed in April of 2004. Nobody respected it. It was signed April 8th, and April 8th itself, there was violation of it. So, what are we going to do? The people of Darfur are going to die. So the option that Alex is talking about, that we have militias in several places that are going to provide security, we have to solidify that, we have to help the people of Darfur to resist their own government. We have to be able to work with the other people of Sudan that are completely being alienated of this. Because for the longest time, the government of Sudan had a blackout in the papers and the news media that it controls people inside Khartoum. When we meet them outside, they come out and say, oh, what is happening in Darfur? You come from Sudan, you tell me. We don't know what is going on. So this is what we need your intervention for. This is what we need you to do, to stand together with the people of Sudan and to help us all find a people-to-people approach to be able to help the people of Darfur.
It's one of the most exciting things about the movement that's generated is that people in Darfur or certainly in Khartoum are learning about what's going on there from all the different websites of all these different organizations. Jennifer.
I would just like to take this opportunity to frame it, what's going on in Darfur, for those of you who may not see it in sort of the longue durée as it relates to the interplay between humanitarian action and international intervention. The period of the 90s showed the positive possibilities for humanitarian work in support of beleaguered populations that were being attacked by oppressive governments or by marauding non-state actors. The period since 9/11 has shown that it is now very difficult to get a consensus at the Security Council for the international community to act with any effectiveness to intervene in a military way in support of populations that are being attacked. And that is what is blocked here. The Security Council is not going to move on this issue. And the wily and observant and malevolent non-state actors and governments, and I would say that there are many of both in acting in Sudan, these wily observers have recognized that you can hamstring the humanitarian community, which actually in its way of delivering food, medical care, shelter, and water, can provide a presence, a bearing witness, and sort of a control rod capacity against marauding forces. What has taken place in Sudan is just block their access and begin to kill some of them. And then you keep them in the garrison towns in the same way that the population is huddled down. And then you're free to act throughout the countryside. So we have several checkmates going on here in Darfur at the international level and at the humanitarian level. And it is a terrible position to be in for those of us who have a notion of certain options and we see they can't be carried out politically. So I think the virtue in this very constrained situation lies in what a number of people on the panel have been saying, which is how can you galvanize grassroots action in this country? Grassroots action is necessary in Europe, and this is something we need you to help us galvanize, and grassroots action in Sudan. That is what needs to happen, because the major forces that were active in the 90s, the humanitarian community and the United Nations, or NATO and regional powers and regional forces like the AU, are not active, not viable, and not among the list of real options.
Thank you. We want to honor people who have persevered in organizing this really extraordinary, Gerard and Andrea and Emily. They came to us some months ago and said, we're going to do something big at BU on Darfur. And we said, yeah, right. And look what they did. It's really extraordinary. And we want to honor your perseverance and your initiative. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion titled Accountable to Humanity, Justice in Darfur. On the panel were Dr. Jennifer Leaning, co-director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, Omer Ismail, fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, and the Reverend Gloria White Hammond, co-chair of the Massachusetts Coalition to Save Darfur. Moderating the discussion was Susanna Serkin, deputy director of Physicians for Human Rights. Earlier, we had a keynote address by writer and activist Dr. Alex DeWall, a fellow of the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard University and director of Justice Africa, London. We began with an introduction by Dr. Jonathan Simon, director of the Center for International Health and Development at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette with help from Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.